broadcasting live from the bunker in North Central Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite need to eat, but mostly drink. Also nearby is Terrible Tommy's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, the insurgent, just plain old box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
That's right. Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger here in the bunker on a Tuesday afternoon. I don't know why it seems later in the week, but I don't know. We got some more rain last night. It rains one day and sunshines the next. That's real good for the crops out there, I'll tell you that. It is June the 24th, 2014. All day today. We've had a big crowd out there at Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse here the last couple of nights. In fact, from the weekend, some of them I don't think have gone home from the weekend. Man, I'll tell you. But you know what? A lot of stuff I send out, I don't think y'all get to hear it, because sometimes it's a little long or you're busy or this or that. One of my favorites in the last couple of months was this interview from the book Dr. Feelgood about this German Jew that developed a fast way to make money, and how he incorporated, once he got to the United States, he started getting all the big shots involved, including the President of the United States, who was a drug addict. And that's right, John F. Kennedy. He was up on drugs all the time, partially because he had this super back pain problem. So I'm going to run that for you. And I was really impressed with this story. I'm not sure whether it's true, but I think it could be checked out pretty much. Here we go.
Bill Burns is a New York Times best-selling author, a magazine publisher, a literary publishing agent, but you probably know him best as one of the co-hosts of the what was a hit series, UFO Hunters, on television. He's got a new companion book out, a companion to the TV series, UFO Hunters, that we can touch on later. But the main subject tonight is his new book, Dr. Feelgood, the shocking story of a doctor who may have changed history, this miracle concoction that he gave to JFK and Marilyn and Elvis and a lot of others. Bill, great to have you on the show.
Thanks, George. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
You know, this stuff is pretty shocking. I read it today. I mean, it's a great book. It's really scary and surprising. I think when people hear this, the allegations that you make in the book, they're going to agree. So I think it's important for us to start with the investigation. What evidence you collected to support this?
One of the things that we did, the book actually began with, it was going to be a biography of the actor Robert Cummings, because he had this precipitous fall from being an A-list movie actor in the 1940s. He was one of Alfred Hitchcock's favorite actors, and he had a hit television show in the 1950s, Love That Bob, and he made appearances in Love American Style and The Twilight Zone. He's really well known. But his life took this precipitous fall during his career, and what we found out was that he was a patient of this doctor, Max Jacobson, since probably the early 1950s when he was in New York doing a Playhouse 90, and it was that injection, those series of injections, and sometimes he was getting them twice a week, three times a week, he'd fly back and forth to New York. They were methamphetamines, 30 to 40% methamphetamines. And the thing about meth is that It is addictive. It's chemically habit-forming, but it also turns you into a bipolar individual. You're manic when you're high. You are clinically depressed. You can't function. And the problem with Cummings was he became clinically depressed. He couldn't function. He became psychotic. And they fired him from the television show My Living Doll. We interviewed the beautiful Julie Newmar, who was his co-star on that show. And she told us this story of how he got fired from that show. That was his last entertainment, his serious television entertainment job. And in studying his life, we found out about all the other people around him in show business. Eddie Fisher, Marilyn Monroe, Cecil B. DeMille, even Charlton Heston, people like that who found themselves getting addicted to meth. And this was the same doctor we knew who treated Jack Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy. Jackie Kennedy for migraines and fatigue, and Jack Kennedy for very severe back pain, and realized this guy had changed history. And it's the story of how a drug infected him, because he was his own addict, infected him, and then infected American politicians. Harry Truman, Richard Nixon wanted to go on these drugs, and Jack Kennedy, and how Kennedy's actions as president, his taking drugs, his taking LSD, he's slipping away from his Secret Service detail to have relationships with women in New York, a psychotic break at the Carlisle Hotel where he was running around naked with the press downstairs in the lobby. All this was happening under the watchful eye of the CIA, who knew that it was drugs that impaired Kennedy's performance at the Vienna summit with Khrushchev in 1961, which brought us to the absolute brink of World War III.
Well, I ask the question because those who worship Kennedy, and there's still a lot of Americans who do, and most Americans feel positive about Kennedy and his presidency in that era, a lot of folks are going to have trouble believing this. That's why I was asking about how you put this thing together. You talked to a lot of people. You got FOIA documents, right?
Oh, yeah. We went into Kennedy's medical records. They're available. We had Max Jacobson's own memoirs. They're available. They're in a library in on Long Island, New York. We spoke to people who were with Kennedy. For example, this one person, Mike Samick, a Congressional Medal of Honor winner. He was a glider pilot during World War II. He was a refugee from Germany at the start of the Holocaust in the 1930s. He would fly the doctor back and forth. He was a pilot. He'd fly the doctor back and forth to the White House, to Washington, from New York on a regular basis to treat Kennedy. He was there when Max Jacobson treated Kennedy at the Carlisle Hotel and basically caused Kennedy to have this psychotic break. He flew Max to Florida to treat Jackie at the Winter White House. So we interviewed eyewitnesses, and we read Kennedy's medical records, which are eye-opening to be sure, and also saw the memos from the FBI about Bobby Kennedy's interest in what his brother was taking.
Let's start with who Dr. Max Jacobson is. Give me the thumbnail bio.
Max Jacobson was an internal medicine specialist. He was an MD, got his MD in Germany, University of Berlin. And he was experimenting early on with things like the cells of eels, the glands from sheep and pigs. What he was trying to figure out was how blood serum can cure a lot of disorders, like multiple sclerosis. And he developed an injection that was so powerful it made people sick. So what he did to make them feel good, hence the name, was he added methamphetamines, his own formula of methamphetamines that basically became the basic formula for that the Nazis used in World War II and the British and the Americans used in World War II, as well as the Japanese. So he developed this methamphetamine formula. He fled to the United States from Paris in the late 1930s, early 1940s, before the war broke out. And by the middle 1940s, he'd established a practice in New York dealing with a lot of people that he met from Paris, like the film director Billy Wilder, and became a doctor to the show business community in New York, injecting them with meth. And his reputation grew. One of his patients was Chuck Spalding, who was Jack Kennedy's roommate at Harvard. And it was Chuck Spalding who, in the fall of 1960, brought Kennedy to Max Jacobson because Kennedy was so weak, he was suffering from fatigue, from back pain, his voice was gone, and it was Jacobson who really got Kennedy back up on his feet, and I think was instrumental in Kennedy's performance in the first debate with Richard Nixon, and that, as you know, that swung the polls. Nixon was ahead going into that first debate. After that first debate, Kennedy was ahead and never lost his lead. So Jacobson really changed history in the 1960 election.
Well, we'll focus on JFK and that whole connection a little bit later. Staying on Max Jacobson now, in those days, in the 40s, when he established his practice, meth was legal, right, at least in some forms?
Oh, absolutely. Meth was not only legal. Meth was being used by the United States government during the war to keep pilots awake. So meth was a very, very legal drug. In fact, we have versions of amphetamines today that are still legal. They are drugs for attention deficit disorder drugs like Ritalin and Adderall. They contain some of the same materials in Max Jacobson's injections.
Did Jacobson tell people what was in it? I mean, I get the general impression from the book, the specific impression from the book, that he would make stuff up. He'd tell them different things that were in it, but never tell them about meth.
That's true. He never told him about meth. In fact, the only way Kennedy found out that it was meth was that Bobby Kennedy took some of the vials of medicine, took them to the FBI, had them analyzed, and that's when he got the formula. Jacobson called them his special vitamin shots. Never talked about methamphetamines.
I was struck by the descriptions, the vivid descriptions of his waiting room, that at any given moment when you'd go in there, you'd have an amazing collection of people.
Right. He would have these salon parties, these literary parties with show business people and writers like Tennessee Williams and Truman Capote. They would start after midnight and they'd run to 4 and 5 in the morning. And if you stayed for those parties, your party favor was a high-potency shot of methamphetamines, and you would leave that party flying. And some of the things that people wrote about those parties were incredible.
Some of these folks had to know eventually, hey, this is something more than vitamins.
Well, one of the stories was that Rod Serling and Bob Cummings, the famous writer Rod Serling, who was one of Max Jacobson's patients, this great story of when Bob Cummings was on the Twilight Zone. This was in the 1960s. And he's having dinner with Rod Serling. And Rod Serling is having this thick steak smothered with onions. He's chain-smoking cigarettes. And Bob Cummings just lays out, because he was a health food nut. In fact, he had a bestseller in the 50s about vitamins and your health. So he lays out his little capsules of vitamins on his plate. And Serling is looking at him and saying, "That's your dinner?" And Cummings says to Serling, "Look at you. You're smoking. You're eating that steak. You'll die before you're 50. I.e., Rod Serling died when he was 50. You'll die before you're 50. And Serling says to Cummings, "Look, we both go to the same doctor. You know what kind of stuff he's injecting in us. So don't tell me about health." So they knew.
You think that Rod Serling's productivity was directly related to these shots he was getting?
Oh, yeah. Rod Serling was working almost 24 hours a day. I mean, when the chance came for him to do Twilight Zone, and he had to convince the network that a show like that, doing those kinds of stories, would work, he had to be a phenomenal producer of continuity, of writing. And it was methamphetamines that really kept him at that furious pace of turning out these shows every single week.
All these people you interviewed, they've told you what the feeling was like when they got these injections. Describe it.
Well, I think the best kind of description came from the singer Eddie Fisher, Princess Leia's father, right? Eddie Fisher, big singer in the 1950s. Phenomenal story about him and meth as well. But Eddie Fisher said that as you began to decline, as you began to get fatigued, when you got a shot of meth, he said it was like you didn't walk out of Max Jacobson's office, you flew out of Max Jacobson's office. It was like flying so fast and so high, and you believed you could do anything. Tennessee Williams said he would go straight for 72 hours, just riding straight for 72, 72 hours, he would never even think about sleeping. But when he crashed, it was like falling from the top of a building, and you never, never hit bottom. That's why you needed that second shot. And, in fact, you saw this on a recent Mad Men, last week's Mad Men, that television show, with John Hamm about Don Draper in the advertising industry. They actually had a Dr. Feelgood character in the office of Sterling Price giving injections to all the ad people. And they were doing tap dancing. They were running around the office. They were acting crazy. The other thing it made you was hypersexual. In addition to feeling very grandiose, it's a psychotic reaction, you felt hypersexual. And Eddie Fisher blamed that on his many, many relationships.
And, of course, that becomes a factor for JFK, too, and we'll get to that as well. I asked the question about the waiting room because you described it as, at any given moment, the amazing array of talent and stars, writers, actors that would be sitting there waiting to see Dr. Feelgood.
That's right. You would have producers like Alan J. Lerner from My Fair Lady, Tennessee Williams, one of our greatest playwrights, Truman Capote, the guy who wrote In Cold Blood and Breakfast at Tiffany's. They were all in that same room waiting for their shots. Anthony Quinn, the actor Anthony Quinn, sitting in that room waiting for their shots. And this is not some high-end waiting room. You're not looking at someplace really fancy. This was a small, cheap office on New York's East Side. It was the only thing Max Jacobson could afford at the time, even though he had a big research lab out on Long Island. And this collection was probably the single greatest collection of American talent, all talking and having a party and eating and whatever and waiting for their methamphetamine shots.
And all of them on speed.
Every one of them on speed.
You also described Dr. Jacobson as sort of disheveled. He had dirty fingernails. The office itself was kind of a wreck.
Well, that was one of the shocking things about this doctor. He was covered in blood. First of all, he self-injected. And that was why his license was taken away, because he was injecting himself. So all the psychological problems that his patients had were the same ones he had. But he'd walk around the office in a lab coat stained with blood. He had track marks up and down his arms. His fingernails were filthy. And people would look at this guy and say, how can this guy be a doctor? But it was the shots themselves that really turned you into a true believer. In fact, Kennedy's description of seeing Max Jacobson, I mean, here's Jack Kennedy, one of the richest people who ever ran for president, right? His father was very rich. He's looking at Jacobson, and he's saying to himself at first, why am I here? Look at this guy. And he looked at this disheveled individual, and it was only after he received his shot that he realized how important this guy could be to his career. But Jacobson was a mess.
Before we get to the JFK section, Cecil B. DeMille, he became pretty dependent on this, so much so that he flew this doctor around with him.
Well, again, one of the funny stories is that DeMille was so dependent on the shots he was getting from Max Jacobson that in order to complete the movie The Ten Commandments, which he filmed in Egypt, he flew Jacobson out to Egypt to live on the set with him and to attend him every day. And in fact, when he wasn't getting, in that very famous scene when Charlton Heston as Moses receives the Ten Commandments, he wasn't getting the high-powered performance out of Heston. So he said to Max Jacobson, give him a double shot of methamphetamines. And so the intensity of Charlton Heston in that movie, The Ten Commandments, he was on meth at the time he did that scene. He stayed with him in Egypt. Then when the time came to promote the movie, Cecil B. DeMille asked Max and his wife Nina to accompany him on the world tour for the movie. The big thing was going to Rome to convince the Pope to get behind the movie, and Jacobson was there at the Vatican meeting the Pope in England and in Germany as well. So back when he met Konrad Adenauer. So yeah, he was like a piece of luggage for all these people, but he felt wonderful.
It's amazing to me that he didn't have more money, that he wasn't wealthy as a result of helping so many rich and powerful people.
On the one hand, he didn't really take money. On the other hand, he had a research facility all the way out on Long Island in which he was manufacturing methamphetamines and shipping out vials of these drugs all around the world. So one of the rumors was, and it's a rumor because I don't have his financial records, but one of the rumors was that he was making a lot of money on drug distribution, and the amount of drugs he was shipping, that too was investigated by the New York State Board of Regents that was examining his medical license. And they noted that this guy was shipping more drugs out and manufacturing, it was a manufacturing facility, and manufacturing more methamphetamine drugs than he could have possibly dispensed to all of his patients because they had his patient records. So we think he was making money on the side from drug distribution, but he lost it all during his license revocation hearings.
I'm trying to remember what the figure was in the book, but I thought it was something like they could account for 29 pounds of meth, which is, you know, that's an amazing amount by itself.
Oh, yeah. And there was a lot more. So that was part of the problem. There was a lot of meth going out of his lab, and what they were able to do was, since they knew how he made it, they could see what shipments he was getting in from the raw materials. And then there was this huge discrepancy between the materials he was receiving and the meth he was distributing to patients. There was a big hole, and they couldn't account for that amount of meth.
Something like the equivalent of 100,000 doses a year that he was distributing?
Yeah, easily. Easily. And that's the problem.
I guess one of the things we can talk about, I don't know if we can do it now, we got about a minute before the break, but whether or not this is related to the meth outbreak. I mean, it's a terrible scourge. It's a terrible drug.
Well, the answer is yes. The short answer is yes, and we could talk about it when we come back, but yeah, absolutely, he was the poster boy for the drug war, and meth in America today is a direct result of what he did in the 1950s and 60s.
Were there benefits, though, that were documentable for his patients in the short term? I'll tell you what, Bill, the music tells us we got to go to break, and of course might be cheesy, but we got a song from Motley Crue called Dr. Feelgood. Take us into the break. Bill Burns, co-author of Dr. Feelgood, the book, sharing with us some horrific stories still to come, in particular about JFK. Stay with us, everyone. Burns about his new book, Dr. Feelgood, this shocking story of this doctor who cooked up this concoction that what he said was vitamins and minerals, some sort of natural supplements, but actually was speed. And the number of people that he got hooked on this stuff is astonishing. We continue the conversation with Bill Burns right after this on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. My guest is Bill Burns, co-author of Dr. Feelgood. Bill, you mentioned briefly that this drug had been distributed to troops during World War II. I guess the Germans really relied on it quite a bit, and that even it's said in your book that even Hitler and Eva Braun may have been on the stuff as well?
Yes. Hitler's doctor was a guy called Alfred Morell, who basically used Max Jacobson's formula, as did the German government, and he was injecting Hitler, giving him capsules as well, on methamphetamines. And this was throughout the entire war, and he was attending Hitler even at in the bunker and up in the Black Forest, up in Hitler's retreat. So yeah, Hitler was on drugs. In fact, History Channel did a piece on that years ago called High Hitler, about his drug use.
You think it was Jacobson's own formula, though?
One of the things Jacobson complains about in his memoirs is that in the 1930s, obviously as the Nazis were coming to power, it was the form of a subpoena. They basically made a demand for specimens of his drug, because he was very well known in Berlin. Specimens of his drug and the formula, and he had to give them over. The brown shirts paid him a visit. He had to give them over, and when he knew that he was on a list of those who was going to be picked up, that's when he fled to Prague. But he gave that formula to the Germans, and he actually knew which pharmaceutical company manufactured those drugs for the German troops as well as for Hitler himself.
You make the point in the book that this guy, Dr. Jacobson, was a bit of a control freak, you know, that he had plenty of his patients, I guess, who over the years tried to find out what was in that stuff because they were worried, gosh, what would happen if something happens to you or I'm separated from it? I'd need to get it, right? But he wouldn't give it to him.
No, he wouldn't. And he was indeed a control freak. In fact, that's one of the symptoms. That's one of the psychotic symptoms of methamphetamine addiction. You become obsessive about maintaining control because what you're afraid of is that the very drug that's keeping you up is you're not going to have it anymore for some reason. So he was a control freak, and that need to control forced him to expand his circle of patients and inject more and more people. There's this fabulous story, didn't make it into the book, that Jacobson was also, another patient of his was Sam Giancana, Momo, Sam Giancana, the Chicago organized crime cartel leader. Well, Sam Giancana had a girlfriend who was Phyllis McGuire of the McGuire sisters, and he was injecting Phyllis McGuire. And she wanted to stop. She said, I can't take this anymore. It's making me sick. She was performing on the Ed Sullivan Show. Jacobson shows up backstage at the Sullivan Show and is actually chasing her around backstage at that theater to give her a shot of methamphetamines before she goes on.
There was another woman, I can't remember the name, but a mistress that that JFK shared with Sam Giancana, who also, I think, was getting shots. Or I think she's listed in the back of your book.
It's Judith Exner Campbell,
yeah.
The very famous Judith Exner, who was the go-between from Kennedy to Sam Giancana, and one of the things she was going between was she was distributing drugs. When Max Jacobson was visiting Las Vegas with Eddie Fisher, that's when he met Giancana, and supposedly at that table, Giancana was complaining about a headache, it wouldn't go away, he was feeling sick. Max said, you know, I can fix you up. And Giancana said, yeah? And he says, I guarantee it. And Giancana made this threat, you're going to guarantee it with your life if you can't. He gave him one shot, and Giancana became hooked.
This doctor, though, I mentioned him being a control freak. I mean, he enjoyed being able to have some sort of influence over powerful people, being invited to these big shot events that going all over the world, right?
He really did. The fact that he got to go to the Kennedy inauguration, that he met Harry Truman, that he met Lyndon Johnson, for a guy who grew up relatively poor, modestly poor in Berlin, first in a little village called Forda in Poland, and then in Berlin, this was to him the kind of the apex of his career, being with all these powerful people, flying on a private plane, going on Air Force One to Europe with the president. This was the apex for him.
All right, into JFK. You mentioned that a friend of his makes the introduction. JFK, as a senator, goes to this office and he sees, wow, what the heck am I doing here? What's going on? But he had terrible health problems at the time.
JFK was so sick that it is likely, given what we now know about Addison's disease and the other things he had back in the 1950s, given that, it is unlikely he would have made it through his second term in office had he won in 1964. That's how seriously ill Kennedy was. And here is one of the worst things about it. Everybody gets sick, people get better, some people don't. But Kennedy had his doctor, Janet Travell, and this letter is actually in the book, in the photo section. He had his doctor, Janet Travell, write a letter for distribution to the press that Kennedy was in absolutely perfect health, even though he had Addison's disease, Crohn's disease. He was taking five shots of Novocaine a day. He was on phenobarbital for his back pain and for his irritable bowel syndrome and, of course, the methamphetamines. But he had her write that letter, and it was an absolute, unabashed, unequivocated lie that he was in perfect health and fit to be president. He couldn't even walk when he wasn't on camera. He was usually on crutches. That's how bad he was.
So he gets a shot, and immediately there's a positive reaction.
He walked into Jacobson's office. He could barely stand up. And there was a quick patient-doctor intake session. Jacobson gave him a shot, and within minutes, Kennedy was feeling better. He returns to Jacobson's office right before the first debate with Richard Nixon. He has no voice left. He's rasping. And he basically complains about all of his symptoms. Jacobson shoots him right in the larynx. And within again, within minutes, his voice comes back. He's full of bounce. He actually almost climbed out of the window. He had so much energy. That's the energy he brought into that first debate with Richard Nixon. He was able to control it, so he didn't seem manic. But the difference between Kennedy and Nixon, you could see those debates that are on the Internet, the difference between Kennedy and Nixon on that first debate made the difference in that election. History changed at that first debate.
So after JFK is elected, he wants Jacobson, he starts inviting him to the White House on a regular basis, right?
Yes, he does. He either comes to New York to get his shots, or he has his friend Mike Samick, who is a World War II hero, to fly him to Washington. The other person who was flying him down was this person, Mark Shaw. This is where it gets interesting. Mark Shaw was this very, very famous high-fashion photographer. Back in the 1950s and 60s, you would see his photographs of Audrey Hepburn. They're famous, and other stars. During World War II, Mark Shaw was OSS. After the war, after 1947, he became an officer in the CIA, a non-official, a NOC, a non-official cover officer for the CIA, because he was traveling all around the world seeing movie stars, traveling to places where CIA officers couldn't really go with complete freedom. He was their eyes and ears. And we even have non-official cover officers in the CIA today, and I've met a few on during UFO Hunters. But this person was CIA. Jacobson, according to his FBI file and his CIA records that are available, you can get them under the Freedom of Information Act now, he was treating Soviet agents. So the Soviets, he was turned in Vienna in the 1930s, obviously before there was a KGB or an NKVD, and then in the United States, he was a Soviet operative. And so here's a doctor treating the President of the United States, who's working for the Soviet Union. Whether he renounced communism at some point in his life, we don't really know. He doesn't talk about it in his memoir. But he was tagged as a Soviet agent by the FBI, by J. Edgar Hoover, and the CIA. One of his patients is a CIA cover officer, a non-official cover officer, who's flying him to the White House to meet the president. Mark Shaw was also the official White House family photographer. So the CIA had a man literally in the family quarters of the Kennedy White House. That's how connected everything was.
Kennedy started calling him, I guess, or had staff members calling under a code name, and that meant you got to drop everything. The president needs a shot.
Right. The code name was Mrs. Dunn. Mrs. Dunn is calling. And when he got that phone call, whatever he was doing, this was presidential information. At one point, after Bobby Kennedy made a real ethnic slur about Jacobson because he knew what Jacobson was injecting into his brother, after that moment, Jacobson said to Kennedy, "I quit. I'm not your doctor anymore. Go find somebody else. I'm not going to take this abuse. I fled Germany. I don't need this in the United States." And Kennedy not only implored him to keep injecting him, but he said, "I want you to move into the White House. We're going to give you quarters in the White House, live there, because I want you on hand 24/7 to give me injections." And Jacobson turned him down. He said, "No, I can't leave New York. I've got too many multiple sclerosis patients that I deal with." So literally, that was the intensity of their relationship.
And Jackie ended up taking it as well.
Jackie was funny because after the birth of John John, and then there was another child that died, it was a miscarriage, Jackie was suffering from phenomenal migraine. She was always camera shy. She always had this issue with appearing in public. And so what would happen is that right after the inauguration, Jacobson got an emergency message that he had to fly down to Palm Beach, which is where Kennedy had the winter White House. He didn't. That's where he met Jackie officially for the first time. She was suffering from a migraine. She could barely move. He gave her a shot, and she, too, became a patient. And, in fact, one of the funny things about this is, remember two moments. One moment was the very famous Jackie Kennedy tour of the White House, where she seemed, if you see that again, she seems not drunk, but her speech is slurring. She seems almost a little bit ditzy. Flash forward to Marilyn Monroe at the Madison Square Garden singing "Happy Birthday, Mr. President." Same thing. She's either drunk, she's ditzy, she's slurring. both women had gotten shots, heavy shots, immediately before they had to appear on camera, because Jackie Kennedy did not want to do the White House tour on television until she got her shot of meth.
Wow. You had the, you mentioned in passing the White House doctor, this physician who starts getting really suspicious and wondering, hey, she contacts Max Jacobson, what the heck are you doing, right?
Yeah, and she said, give me some of the drug, and he says, no. You know, I will give you a shot so you can know what it feels like, but no, it's my formula and you can't have it. And she mistrusted him, he mistrusted her, and every single doctor that Kennedy then had. There was this admiral who was actually attending the Parkland Hospital autopsy of Kennedy. They all said, get rid of this guy Jacobson, he's a danger.
But yet Kennedy always put him above the rest of the doctors and trusted him or kept him close, and the other guy's advice got ignored.
That's the model of addiction. You're exactly right. Kennedy elevated Jacobson to almost divine status within his inner circle at the White House. He never went too far from Jacobson, and the other doctors who knew what Kennedy was getting, who knew the dangers of that drug, they said, get rid of this guy. In fact, one person who told us about the dangers of this drug, actually not us, but C. David Heyman, who turned over those notes, was John F. Kennedy Jr. John F. Kennedy Jr. told David Heyman that his mother, Jackie's death from lymphoma, was one of the results of taking shots from Max Jacobson.
And Robert Kennedy was suspicious.
Robert Kennedy threw them out of the White House. He said, you guys get out of here, go back to New York with the rest of you. I don't want you treating my brother. And he confronts his brother about it and says to his brother, do you know what this stuff is? See, that's how Kennedy found out that it was methamphetamines. He shows them this stuff. And Kennedy says, I don't care if it's horse piss, it makes me feel good. And that was the end of Bobby Kennedy's intervention in stopping Jacobson from giving his brother drugs. But remember, this was only, I mean only, this was still a three-year run from fall 1960 to the time that Kennedy was assassinated in November 1963.
The most dramatic moment where this drug plays a role is the summit meeting with Khrushchev. Tell that story.
Well, Kennedy ordered Jacobson and his wife Nina to fly with him to Vienna for the summit. But he didn't want the press to know. The press was suspicious. Who was the strange-looking guy with the thick black glasses, with the black curly hair, who always looked disheveled? Who was this guy following the president around? He had this black satchel. Is he a doctor? What kind of a doctor? Press was getting very, very suspicious about this. So Kennedy booked Jacobson on an Air France flight, on a commercial flight to Europe. And then he actually flew on Air Force One to Vienna. There, he's in a kind of an anteroom waiting for Kennedy. He gives Kennedy his shot and says, now I'm giving you a lot, Mr. President, so you have to be careful. I don't want to overdose you. They expected Khrushchev momentarily. What happened was that Khrushchev was late. He kept on delaying it. Now, an interesting thing is that the week before Jacobson left for the summit, his office was broken into, and all his medical records were rifled through. And the question is, who did it? Was it the CIA? Was it the FBI? Was it the KGB? He didn't know. He expected it was the KGB. So they had all the records. Khrushchev knew that he had a man in the Kennedy entourage who was giving Kennedy methamphetamines. After all, Jacobson had been turned by the Soviets in the 1930s. So Khrushchev holds that he doesn't show up. He's late and late and late. Kennedy begins to get down, right? The drug is wearing off. He needs more drugs. He's begging Jacobson for another injection. He gives him one. Finally, by the time Khrushchev shows up, Kennedy had been overdosed. His speech is slurring. He's stumbling around. He can't focus. Khrushchev is laughing, thinking this guy's a pushover. I'm going to roll this guy right over. And it's because of that meeting in Vienna when Khrushchev says to Kennedy, if you don't get out of Berlin, if you don't leave, I'm going to close Berlin down, period. And, of course, the Berlin Wall went up in 1962. But that's what he threatens. He threatens a war. And Kennedy leaves that Vienna meeting. He was completely drugged out, totally strung out. He tells James Reston of the New York Times that was the worst day of his life. And sure enough, shortly thereafter, the Cuban Missile Crisis begins because Khrushchev believes he has a hand to play. He can force Kennedy to accept guided missiles in Cuba. The backstory of all this, and we believe that's a direct result of Jacobson's injections of methamphetamines into Kennedy because Khrushchev thought he was a pushover. But one of the things we found out, actually it was Dick Morris who told us, that the Soviets in 1961 did not have guided missiles capable of reaching the United States. They had no ICBMs. They had intermediate-range ballistic missiles. They could cover Europe, but they couldn't reach the United States. Khrushchev never told the communist leadership and the people in the Supreme Soviet that they didn't have intercontinental ballistic missiles, only IRBMs. That whole story, this is an example of how Khrushchev overplayed his hand at that Vienna summit and the Cuban Missile Crisis, because when Khrushchev was forced to stand down, to turn his ships away after we blockaded Cuba, it was only then that he told the powers that be in the Soviet Union they never had guided missiles that could reach the United States. And that was the beginning of Khrushchev's downfall. So in an interesting way, again, it wasn't only Kennedy that was affected by it. Khrushchev's career was affected by it as well.
My gosh. And then, of course, the story spreads to Marilyn Monroe. I thought that was one of the most interesting chapters in the book because it also delves into topics near and dear to our heart, Bill, about UFOs and secret bases, things of that sort. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll get into that. Also, Elvis, and then the career of Mickey Mantle, one of the all-time greatest baseball players. You know, he comes into contact with this doctor right at the peak, at a key point of his career. And heck, there's a really long list of other folks that that you talk to and who are on the list of clients of this doctor that it's pretty much amazing. We'll also touch on UFO Hunters, the other new book that you got out, and open up the phone lines with questions from our listeners. Stay with us, everyone. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.
New figures.
Well, what did you think about that? Yeah, I think I played that for you once before. That's only about half of the program. I don't know. For some reason, I don't think I have the other. Maybe someplace, but I'm sure you could get it from Coast to Coast Radio. But I've got the book on tape, Dr. Feelgood, which you can get. I think I got it through Amazon. And it is wild. Believe me, you know how wild this Coast to Coast show was. Well, this is even wilder, the whole book. And this is why I said for a long time there was something wrong with Hitler. And started in the late 30s. And it's my opinion that he was getting this treatment, like they say, from this Jew through Dr. Morell. And Dr. Morell was sort of a weird doctor, too. And just like with Kennedy and this Jacobson, Morell had a higher position with Hitler than about anybody else around Hitler. In fact, there were those in Hitler's inner circle that wanted to do away with Dr. Morell, who obviously was pirating or using or buying this shit from the Jew, Jacobson. So when you see things in Hitler's actions during World War II and leading up to World War II that don't make much sense, think about it, he was being shot up with methamphetamines, just like Kennedy and all these other people were. So he, especially the invasion of Russia, Barbarossa, which was to me, the greatest mistake that Germany ever made. And it's changed the world terribly because of it. It's really interesting how so many of our leaders and the people we always look up to turn out to be not just feet of clay, but feet of shit. I'm trying to remember whether this Judith Exner that was a girlfriend of Kennedy was the same Judith that was involved in the development of cancer weapons down there in Louisiana during the period they were trying to knock off Castro. Her name was Judith. I don't think it was Judith Exner, but that's another wild story, that they were developing fast-acting cancer viruses, and they were experimenting on prisoners from Angola prison, one of the worst prisons in the United States. And they brought them over there to New Orleans and injected them to see how long it would take for them to die. That's another big story. And this is why I normally say you can't trust anybody with lots of power. I tell you, they all turn out in the end to have feet of clay. Whether it's Putin or whether it's Obama, whether it's Reagan, whether it's Hitler, no matter who it is, people with power can hide things and get away with things that you would never put up with or never agree to. If people knew the true extent of the corruption of the people in the Congress and the U.S. Senate, drug addicts, child molesters, and all the things that go along with that, if you truly knew that, well, you probably wouldn't do anything, because corruption seems to be something that people put up with as long as powerful people do it. And the other people are afraid to take action, too cowardly to do anything. And so it goes on and goes on and goes on. Why do you think the blacks were ever allowed to get to the point where they're at right now? It's all total corruption. It's got nothing to do with loving the black race. You kidding? Are you kidding? Yeah. They want to uplift the downtrodden Negroes? Bullshit. But they are afraid of them, because if they do rise up and burn down half the town, that's a lot of money they lose. So that's one thing. Actually, that's the only card the Negro has to play, unless he's given cards by the white man. The only cards the Negro has to play is violence. And that's it. There's nothing else. Everything else is given to him on a silver platter. And, of course, that's why the federal government and the powers that be want to keep the black race drugged up 24/7. Keep them drugged up, screwed up, so they don't rise up. Yeah. But, you see, they keep you, the media, try to keep us all corralled with nonsense stories and bullshit news that means nothing. You know, like them going on and on today about, we just have to convince the leader of Iraq to get the Sunnis and the Shiites together and everybody will live in peace. Horse shit. Those people are not going to ever live in peace. The only time they live in peace is when they got a strong man like Saddam Hussein to kick their ass. That's all. But anyhow, stories like this, FIFA, you know, this is the governing body of the football, soccer. FIFA is concerned by Germany fans in black face makeup. The European Anti-Discrimination Network. See, this is all bullshit to keep you busy worrying about whether somebody don't like a nigger or something, or whether the nigger don't like the white guy. Anti-Discrimination Network FAIR had previously submitted a complaint to FIFA over several neo-Nazi banners displayed at matches involving Russia and Croatia. Is something like a banner. Well, let's see. I didn't get the whole thing up here. See if I can get it up here. Let's see. Where are we at? We always take any evidence or submissions to our disciplinary committee. Yeah. It is the disciplinary committee that will meet, she said. If they see any grounds, they will open proceedings. Then it's up to the disciplinary commission to take the decision, unquote. During the match, which finished as a 2-2 draw, a German fan with a pro-Nazi message written on his body evaded stewards and invaded the pitch. He was eventually led away by Ghana midfielder Sully Muntari. The European Anti-Discrimination Network FAIR had previously submitted a complaint to FIFA over several neo-Nazi banners displayed at matches involving Russia and Croatia. Don't you realize this is all false flag bullshit just to keep people busy? The whole anti-racist thing is nothing but a false flag. People are going to be racist or they're not going to be racist. Either they're going to be racial separatists or they're not going to be. Either they're going to be segregationists or integrationists. Quote, if something like a banner is spotted, it will be removed, the FIFA spokesman said. If something is not spotted and someone has images of it, then if anyone submits evidence of those things, then our disciplinary committee will consider it. We clearly have zero tolerance for any form of discrimination, except against white racists or white racial separatists. And then we tolerate any kind of discrimination. This is all bullshit whistling past the graveyard. While we're almost on the verge of war in Europe and Middle East again. They're worried about whether somebody yells at a nigger at a football game just to keep you distracted, keep millions of people all over the world distracted watching the football game and watching out for one of those terrible neo-Nazis. Well, they're worried about that oil down in South Sudan. Khartoum, Dateline Khartoum. Germany extends a mandate of its forces serving in UNAMID, South Sudan. That's where all the oil is, boys and girls. The German government decided to extend the mandate of its forces serving in the UN missions in Darfur and South Sudan. So as to contribute to the enhancement of security situation in said areas. The mandate, both missions, expires by the end of this year. It is to enhancement of security for who? The people? Bullshit. They don't care about the people. They're starving to death down there. They got disease up one side and down the other. That security is to secure those oil fields. That's what that's all about. Why don't you just come out and say it, you cowardly sons of bitches? A statement of the German Media Center said the Bundestag, German parliament, had approved the cabinet's decision to extend the mandate of German forces in the two missions till December 31st. At most, 50 male and female soldiers will be assigned to each mission. The statement also said Germans still mean to take part in the two UN missions, the African Union and the UN joint missions in Darfur and the UN mission in South Sudan. The duty of these missions is to enhance the security status in Darfur and to build peace in South Sudan. Do you really believe the powerful people in Germany or the United States or England or any place else give one fuck about those niggers down there in Sudan? Do you think they give one fuck about them? No, it's all about the goodies in the ground, the minerals, the oil, or anything like that. Suddenly, it's important. If anything, oil fields are threatened or anything like that. Suddenly, we've got to rush to the defense of these poor Sudanese niggers. We got to die to save them, you know. And also, while we're at it, we'll save those oil wells for BP and all those guys. Yeah, sure. It's all bullshit. It's all bullshit. Now, here's another football false flag. Almost everything now in the news is false flag bullshit. Mexico cleared over allegations of homophobic chanting by their fans during the World Cup 2014 match against Black Cameroon. Mexico has been cleared of improper conduct by their fans following complaints that their supporters use homophobic chants. What do they do? Yell, homosexual, homosexual, homosexual. No, they said puta, puto, which always meant a Spanish-speaking prostitute to me, but these fans are using it in a way of making the homophobic. The homos feel bad. The fan shouts of puto when the opposing keeper takes a goal kick is commonplace in Mexican football. But anti-discrimination group FARE, F-A-R-E, reported it to FIFA on the basis that it was homophobic language. The Mexican Federation of Association Football was charged with improper conduct, but has been cleared. Well, either they yelled puto, or they didn't yell puto. I mean... FIFA spokesman said disciplinary proceedings were opened against Mexico for improper conduct of spectators during the match. The FIFA disciplinary committee has decided that the incident in question is not considered insulting in this specific contest. In other words, if we shut down a game, it's going to cost millions of dollars in advertising, and we're just going to have to make these little statements and then go on and shrug our shoulders and say, isn't it terrible? And then after the football World Cup is over, we'll discuss all this racism for years, man. It'll go on. Oh, my God, there's people who go to football games who are racist and homophobic. Well, I see Israel's bombing the shit out of Syria. That's good news. Now that'll leave Syria free maybe to throw a few things over there at Israel. How about that? More fun and games. Yeah, it's exciting. Get them. Bomb them. Kill them. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. I'm out of here, man. For Tuesday, I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Yeah. 14.5, don't let all this bullshit get you down because 90% of it is straight out bullshit. It's the man behind the machine with the fog coming out, and he's the Great Oz, and he is nothing but a paper bag. As the Chinese said years ago, decades ago, U.S. is a paper tiger. Washington is a paper tiger. 14.5.